Welcome to episode 20. It's our deca episode, whatever it's supposed to be. Anyway, this is the day before Valentine's Day, February 13th, and it's a good time to cuddle up and listen to us talk about film noir, because that's a very romantic thing. That's first up on this episode, and then following that, our usual trivia question. Steven's going to tell us how to pull off a caper, just in case we ever find ourselves in need of pulling off one last job and steal the crown jewels or something like that. It does happen every once in a while, and it's kind of annoying, especially if you don't know how to do it. And our top six list for this week is distinctly different sequels. And wrapping things up, we're going to talk about a couple of books about making movies, one of which is called Making Movies, and it is the prize that we've been offering for our Oscar games that we've been running. So if you want to learn a bit more about the prize, definitely listen to that segment. And I am Sam Stoddard.
And I'm Stephen Keller, and can someone call the police? Because a group of identically dressed men in black suits and hats just walked into my priceless art collection and ripped off my most priceless piece of artwork. I can't figure it out. Sam, can you help me out?
Yes, and I...
Was it you?
No.
It was not. It was you.
No.
I never suspected it was you, so it must be you.
Not only that, Stephen, I am not in the vault as we speak.
All right, I'm calling the SWAT team right now. I'm going to get you. You can run, but you can't hide. We will find you.
It was a low-rent office in a lower-rent part of town. Wasn't much, but it was mine, and for some reason, that made me feel better. It was almost time to knock off work and knock back a few with the boys down at the local watering hole when she walked in. The sun spilled into the room through my half-closed blinds and cast stripes on her as she walked across the carpet. The light made her look like a zebra, I thought, and I watched her with all the attention to detail a naturalist would pay a fine specimen. Then I saw her face. Not a zebra at all, but a lioness who stalks a zebra. She was a walking contradiction, graceful but dangerous, with as many sharp angles as she had curves. Her legs were longer than my list of creditors, and that made me wish I had a stiff drink. She was going to be trouble. They all are, but she looked like the rare type who might actually be worth it. Those are the ones you really have to watch out for. She pushed on the side of my desk. She took a lone soldier from her silver cigarette case. She put it to her lips, and as I lit it, she spoke. "My name is Noir," she said. Film noir. And that little bit of cheesy introduction is our introduction to our sort of continuing discussion we had last week, talking about film style. We talked about German expressionism, and now we're going to talk about the sort of American form of expressionism, film noir, which, if you couldn't tell, is something of a contradiction. No one can figure out exactly what it is, but we all know it when we see it. It's the style of trench coats and fedoras, of guns and gangsters and dangerous women and the men who fall for them. It's worth talking about because I think you hear the word a lot, but what exactly is film noir? Well, as an overview, it comes from the French word for black. Noir, of course, is the French word for black, only they pronounce it with a different sounding R that I'm not going to try and emulate. And French film critics in the 1940s and 1950s used the term film noir to describe a bunch of dark American movies that they noticed were being created. It's similar to a type of novel that was being published in France, crime novels, which were called noir. And so these French critics sort of noticed this trend in American films, and they applied the same term to it. And in fact, though, in America, it wasn't until the 60s and 70s, after film noir had basically ended, that Americans started realizing, oh, I guess we had been directing these movies, though interestingly, many of the great film noirs directed by foreigners. The interesting thing about noir, though, is it's not really a genre. We think of a genre as being more of a setting with specific conventions, a western, or a comedy, or a drama. Noir kind of goes through all of those. It's more of a style. In particular, it's a darkness of tone and of style. The movies are about dark subjects, and they are dark. And they have a very expressionistic influence. And just to recap, expressionism is the idea that the way the movie looks should reflect what the characters think and feel. And so noir is about people who are dark and conflicted, and so it looks the same way. And in large part, it reflects a shift in American culture. Noir really kicks up steam in the 1940s, particularly right toward the end and after World War II, when obviously World War II was a momentous shift in American culture, and noir kind of precedes and reflects it. It comments on that shift in changing of American values. So where'd it come from? Well, we mentioned before it largely comes from German expressionism, and in particular one director, Fritz Lang, we'll talk about in a little bit. But German expressionism, again, has a dark tone, creepy atmosphere a lot of times, and real great use of black and white for high contrast filmography and shadows and settings, and also a lot of non-realistic sets. Art direction that in general just doesn't look like it should, and that is focusing on style more than realism. It also comes a lot, like I mentioned a second ago, from World War II. In particular, World War II exposed a lot of Americans to horrific things. Think of all the American soldiers who fought in the Pacific theater or the European theater who saw these terrible acts of murder and violence and came back and tried to resume normal lives. And it also redefined the role of women in America, because this is the first time where women really start having to go to work. As the men all leave to go fight, a lot of women take up jobs in factories and other industrial areas because it was necessary. And so this, of course, changed the women who worked these roles and realized that, you know, there was a realization that women didn't just have to be housewives, and this is going to create some conflict in American society. And this also is reflected in noir. I mentioned, of course, a little earlier, the femme fatale, the beautiful woman who's as deadly as she is gorgeous, and I think a lot of this changing attitude about women are reflected in noir. And it also brought a lot of European sensibilities to America, because a lot of the great European filmmakers fled Europe to America to escape the horrors of World War II. So you think of some of the great directors of film noir, Billy Wilder or Fritz Lang, these were European immigrants who came to America, and not just directors, but also cinematographers and set designers and actors. A lot of people came to America to get away from World War II. And it also has its roots in a couple more American things, particularly the hard-boiled fiction of the 30s and 40s. Think of Mickey Spillane or Dashiell Hammett or Raymond Chandler, who wrote these great detective stories about murders and thugs. And these were popular in the 30s, and especially going into the 40s, and as the paperback becomes something that is available, these become really popular. And noir often is about crime and borrows particularly from this genre that's called the hard-boiled fiction. And it's also, in a way, an outgrowth of the gangster movies of the 20s and the 30s. Noir will tone down a lot of the more overt, crazy, over-the-top violence and some of the campier aspects of some of the gangster movies. You know, is this the end of Little Rico? That's not the kind of thing you're going to see in a noir movie necessarily, but a lot of those elements are going to come into noir. But again, I'm sort of talking around it. What is noir? It's mood more than it is anything else, I think. It's mood and ethic system. It's dark and it's deadly, but it's difficult to pin down. No one really knows for sure when noir began. Some people say the 30s, some say the 40s. But we all kind of agree that it ended in 1958 with the release of Orson Welles' film Touch of Evil. That's sort of considered the last of the classic noir. But in another sense, we've never really stopped making noir. And there are examples of noir films throughout history since the 30s going on to the present. They're still coming out. So it's strange in a sense that we think of it as a very limited thing. Noir is definitely tied to the 40s especially, and also to the 50s. But we've never really stopped making them.
I think what the dividing line is, as you mentioned earlier, is as soon as we became aware that this noir thing was a genre and it had a certain style to it, once you become aware of that, I don't think you can go back and make them, at least in the classic style, because they're always a little bit self-conscious. You're trying to make that kind of movie. I was looking up a quote. Robert Mitchum actually said, "We call them B-movies," about the noir movies that he made in the 40s and 50s, and it was only later that this term became applied and began to be seen as its own entity, and so everything after that is made a little self-consciously, and we call that neo-noir, of course.
Right, and because these movies weren't trying to capture the values of that time period, they simply reflected the values of the time period because they were made by people who had those values. So, yeah, that's probably as much as anything sort of the dividing once culture shifted. And also worth noting, once color became the dominant mode of making movies, noir was definitely on its way out because noir relies so heavily on black and white. There are some color noir, but the vast majority of what we think of as the great noir are black and white. And so noir also is typified by a value system that is completely different from the normal Hollywood value system, which rewards heroes and punishes villains and likes to draw clear distinctions between the two. The value system in noir film is very bleak. Noir characters are often people who do things for very selfish reasons. They're not painted necessarily as evil villains, but they're painted as humans who are led down these dark and dangerous paths by their own selfish motivations. There's something interesting here as well. The production code at the time, the sort of enforced rating system, wasn't really a rating system so much as it was, you're not going to make any movies that portray these bad things that all the studios followed. It said that you couldn't let people be rewarded for bad things. So criminals could not be shown as profiting ultimately from their actions. And so in these movies, ultimately a lot of the characters are tragic because the studios will not let them really get away with it. but they walked a real thin line a lot of times of almost getting away with it, or of making movies where the main character is a bad guy who only kind of gets his comeuppance, and only maybe not necessarily, they don't all end up with the main character in jail, that kind of a thing. It's not always that, you know, the cops come in and save the day. And in fact, this is sort of tied into the general theme in noir, which is the world itself is a dark and corrupt place. And a lot of this comes from the hard-boiled fiction of the 30s and 40s. I think particularly of Raymond Chandler, who wrote the character Philip Marlowe, the classic detective. Most of his novels have been made into some of the very famous classic noirs, such as The Big Sleep. But in the Chandler novels, the cops and the politicians are almost always full of corruptness, and the reason that gangsters and organized crime are able to exist is just because they have the quite explicit cooperation of the authorities. This is a sort of a subversion of the more typical American value system where you think, you know, those who are in charge have our best interests. Noir rejects that, and so, not to get too academic out here, but I think something interesting that so much noir takes place in big cities. There's, of course, that recurring theme throughout literary history. There's the story of the young man from the country, the young man or woman from the country, who goes to the big city and is corrupted by the big city, and either meets a tragic death or returns, escapes the big city. Well, there's a lot of that in noir, I think. But here the whole world is corrupt. There's a character who, you know, may be kind of cynical, but who goes down a dark path, and the realization isn't that, oh, it's the big city that's evil, it's that everywhere is corrupt. And the idea that there is some innocence is the false idea, that most people who don't see it aren't really living the truth. And that is definitely a post-World War II idea, this idea of the American idealism kind of being shattered very, very abruptly by World War II.
And not only that, but none of the people are good either. The evil is not just pervasive in terms of place, but it goes inside as well. I think one of the few things you can use to distinguish a noir from other types of movies is if there are any good guys. Let's say The Big Sleep. I mean, there's the detective, and he's obviously a better character than the evil villains, but he's not really a shining example of what is good and right in the world, too. He has a lot of vices and prejudices and things like that. So I think if you see a good guy, you're not really in the full spirit of noir. What's really weird, though, is you don't, at least I don't, come away from a noir thinking that the world is evil. It just uses that premise, but it isn't really oppressive with it.
Really? I guess I disagree with you then. I mean,
okay.
You mentioned The Big Sleep. I like that choice because Bogart is one of the more heroic of the noir heroes, the characters he plays. And his Philip Marlowe in The Big Sleep is kind of trying to be a good guy, but, you know, he covers up a murder, the sort of central murder that kicks everything off.
Yeah.
But I definitely think that that's a world where everything is a little corrupt and the gangsters control things.
Well, sure. I guess I'm just saying I don't feel oppressed by that. I don't feel dragged down by this gloom and pessimism. It's sort of an exhilarating use of that same idea.
Interesting. Well, what about a movie like, okay, Double Indemnity, a movie I want to talk about anyway. 1944, probably the most archetypal noir film. If you want to think what a noir movie is, you watch Double Indemnity and you'll get it all. But it's the idea that the basic premise is Fred McMurray plays this insurance salesman who is seduced by Barbara Stanwyck, and she wants him to kill her husband. And she's just a suburban California housewife. I think it's this idea that when he walks in, just making an insurance sale call, here's someone who's plotting murder. And she doesn't seem like she should be, that even in, you know, a nice, rich, upscale neighborhood, there are people plotting murder. I think that's what's going on in noir, that all around us, there are people who are bad.
Yeah, but again, you know, the fact that although this world is corrupt and everybody in it is corrupt, it doesn't pay off. And I think maybe that's the key, that it doesn't make it so oppressive, you know, on a personal level. It doesn't hit you like, wow, this really stinks living here. You get maybe, oh, I don't want to use the word hope, that's too much, but you get a little bit of relief in the sense that there's no payoff for this evil.
Mm. Well, in a sense, there's no real payoff for anyone. That's why I like, if you look at, again, going back to Bogart, because I think he's one of the lighter of the heroes, his characters are often very cynical, and that's how they cope with it.
Yeah.
The Bogart noir character is able to handle, especially if you think of The Big Sleep of the Maltese Falcon, he's able to handle the darkness and grimness of the world because he has a sense of humor about it. He's going to crack wise, and he's going to be who he is regardless of everything else. But again, you know, no one really gets rewarded for doing much at all in these movies. Everyone kind of gets screwed in the end.
True, yeah.
And of course, noir is also in particular a style. You see a lot of movies that look like noir that don't really have some of the thematic elements that noir has. And that style is a lot of high contrast photography where your blacks are really, really black. You have brights and you have shadows and not a lot of mid-tones. And there's also a very somber mood, generally. And again, we have a lot of expressionistic elements, like we talked about from German expressionism last week. A lot of point-of-view shots, perhaps. A lot of cramped sets. A lot of sense that the city and the world is oppressing its heroes, who aren't really that heroic. And another stylistic thematic element is the femme fatale, the woman who isn't some innocent girl we tend to think of when you think of a lot of Hollywood movies from before this period. And there's a lot of implied sexual content. Of course, in the 1940s, you weren't allowed to really talk about sex at all, but a lot of these movies really skirt it. The subtext is barely a subtext. It's practically there. So let's talk about Fritz Lang. We talked about as being one of the most important expressionistic filmmakers. Sam, why is he so important to film noir?
Well, film noir, at least the visual styles, as you said before, comes from expressionism. German expressionism very definitely inspired film noir. I think if we didn't have the former, we certainly wouldn't have the latter, or at least not in the same form. And Lang is important because he was one of the people that worked in both. He made Metropolis and M, as we said last week, and these are two of the landmarks of German expressionism. And then he goes on and comes to America and starts making film noir, and he's on the forefront of inventing the genre. Fury, he made in 1936, a very great and defining, you know, there's a number of films that lead up to noir, The Maltese Falcon and I'm a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, but he's making one of these that are very influential and then would go on to make more pure noir through in the 40s, throughout the 50s. I think the best well-known is The Big Heat, but there's also The Woman in the Window and Scarlet Street and things. And I think he's more revered for expressionism, but certainly he's on the cutting edge for noir. So he's helping define the genre with everybody else.
Absolutely. And again, like I mentioned earlier, a lot of people who worked in German expressionism are working in Hollywood at this time. So there's a real direct link. It's not just style. And so we don't have time to cover every noir movie because there are tons of them. Of course, Hollywood made a bunch of movies at this period of time. The studio system is at its peak, really. But we mentioned Maltese Falcon. That was a 1941 movie with Humphrey Bogart. It was John Huston's directorial debut. And a lot of people consider this a sort of proto-noir. It's not quite a noir film, but it sets up a lot of conventions. It's one of the definitive detective movies. Bogart plays Sam Spade, probably one of the most famous detectives from the 20th century, and he's going to track down this missing statue, and there's lots of criminals who are all trying to get it. But at the end of the movie, I mean, the Bogart character, Sam Spade, is a good guy, and he does the right thing at the end, and I think that's why a lot of people don't really consider this a full-fledged noir, even though a lot of noir characters are going to end up being detectives or investigators or reporter or something like that. They borrow a lot from the Maltese Falcon. And then in 1942, you have a movie called This Gun for Hire, starring Alan Ladd and Veronica Lake. And the two of them, Ladd and Lake, are going to become one of the big screen couples when you think of noir films. And it's a movie about a hitman, which there you go straight off the bat. Your character is a hitman. That's not something that you're going to think of as being a real heroic type of character. But, you know, he's kind of got a softer side and this complex plot, and that's sort of one of the hallmarks of noir as well, these complex, labyrinthine plots where everything comes together. And just to sort of mention how noir was not limited to anything specific, Hitchcock, in 1943, made another movie that a lot of people think of as being sort of a precursor to noir films. That was Shadow of a Doubt, which is a thriller which stars Joseph Cotten as this killer who comes to this small town to stay with his family, who doesn't realize that he's this evil person. And it's shot in a lot of ways like a noir, though it's not at all bleak the way noir films tend to be, but there's certainly an edge of that noir value system in the Cotten character. Obviously, these are just a small sampling. There's lots of other movies. Noir is going to branch out into all sorts of genres, and even at this time, it's going to be in lots of other movies, so don't consider this list at all authoritative. I mean, we think of noir as being absolutely associated with big cities and trench coats and black Cadillacs, but there were even movies like The Gunfighter from 1950 is a Western that a lot of people consider noir. There were musicals that had noir elements. It's going to affect everything, and that's why it's hard to really specify a sort of real timeline for noir. You can just list a bunch of movies that have noir elements and see whether or not they are, but by 1944, the most basic noir elements have sort of solidified in Double Indemnity, directed by Billy Wilder. We've talked about already a bit, but again, we have a femme fatale in Stanwyck, and she is about as femme fatale as you can get. And it's about murder and obsession, and it has all the noir themes, and the heroes don't get away with it, and things don't work out well, and so there you go. There are some other notable noir movies I want to just mention, especially for the link to expressionism. Dark Passage, another film starring Humphrey Bogart and also starring Lauren Bacall, is interesting because pretty much the entire first half of the film is shot from the point of view of the main character, Humphrey Bogart. You know, you see his hands and you hear his voice, but you don't see his face because we're looking through his eyes, and that is pretty much as expressionistic as you can get, literally making the camera camera, the point of view of the main character. And again, the last film that people would generally consider the classic noir is 1958. Orson Welles releases Touch of Evil. We've talked about it before on the podcast. Again, it stars Charlton Heston as a cop in Mexico trying to unravel this explosion and these murders. And in this movie, we're going to find again that some of the authorities, the people who are in power, are the bad guys.
There's some other movies that I think I'd also like to add real quick. There's Laura from 1944, which is actually reminds me of Rebecca, the Hitchcock movie, but Laura is a murder mystery that has a very noir tone to it. And also talking about other genres, Odd Man Out by Carol Reed in 1947 is a wartime espionage noir. And then 1945, we have another exception to the rule. This is Leave Her to Heaven, and it's made in color. It's a color noir. I'm not sure how it works. I'm not entirely convinced it wouldn't be better in black and white, but it is in color, and it does work for whatever reason, using the cinematography to contrast the world rather than complement it as black and white would. Gilda in 1946 is kind of a weird noir that ends with a happy ending, and I think that's definitely misplaced, but it's breaking the rules and it fits the genre or the style or whatever you want to call it. The Third Man we talked about on an earlier episode, and we weren't really sure it was noir, but it definitely follows a lot of the same conventions and visual styles.
Another Billy Wilder film worth mentioning is Sunset Boulevard, which strays more from the noir conventions but uses much of the noir style. But anyway, we don't want to make it sound at all like noir just ends in 1958 with Touch of Evil. It continues to go on for a long period of time, and we're still making noir today, but we don't call those necessarily straight noir films, they're called neo-noir. And so we want to spend some time in our next episode talking about that, what kind of movies they are, what makes them interesting and different from classic noir, and why you should care about them. So tune in next week, and we'll talk more about neo-noir.
The 1925 comedy Gold Rush, one of Charlie Chaplin's most celebrated films, contains a classic scene where Chaplin is so hungry, just absolutely starving, that he eats, quite nonchalantly, a boot. And he puts it on his plate and he eats it up and even twirls the shoelaces around his fork like spaghetti. It's a great scene. But he didn't really eat an actual boot when he was shooting it, of course. Even in 1925, they had this thing called movie magic. And this week's trivia question is, what were the boots really made of? Do you know this, Stephen?
No, I've seen the movie. I know the scene you're talking about, but I've never considered what he actually ate.
Okay, well, we're going to find out toward the end of this episode.
Man, you know what happened to me the other day, Sam?
What happened to you the other day?
Well, I was going to retire from my life as an international art thief.
Yeah.
But my best friend got in trouble with the mob. I don't know, something about some unpaid debts. And I had to get back in and do one last big score in order to save his life.
Yeah, well.
I hate it.
It's nice of you to do that.
So I thought maybe I would share with our readers some of my helpful tips that I like to use when I go to pull off a caper, you know, a big heist. I got to steal something, make that big, huge payday. And I thought, you know, in sort of the spirit of my previous thing, which I explained how to survive an action movie, I wanted to let them know how to pull off a great heist. And to get started, the important thing, I think, is to set the tone correctly. You want to be the kind of guy who steals things with a little bit of class and style and a light, humorous edge. What you don't want to do is be a sort of serious kind of thief, always like talking about killing people. And you get too serious and greedy, probably end up dead. Keep it light, keep it comical, be a smooth, refined kind of thief. You don't want to be the guy who's a mobster or tangling with those dudes, because those, I don't know, people I know who do that, they seem to end tragically. And what you don't want to do, and this is going to be very, very key, you don't want to be in France or be speaking French. Maybe you can be in France if you're an American, but try to be French. I've never ever seen any French capers go off that don't involve pretty much everyone involved in them being killed by the end of the heist. That's, I don't know what it is. Just stay away from that. You know, it's part of keeping it light and airy, so not serious and not French. That's going to be important.
I think not French is a good rule of thumb just ordinarily.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think we've made that very clear. So, you have something you'll want to steal. I don't know what it is. It's an important jewel, a famous painting or statue. Maybe it's some money or special coins. Who knows? Anyway, the important thing is someone possesses that thing
either some rich guy that you don't like who owns it, or whatever. What you want to start by doing is by taunting the person that you're going to rip off. It's important that you go ahead and establish some sort of, villain you're going to be ripping off. Because, like I said, you don't want to be stealing from a great person. So make sure you know you're not going to rip off the nun charity drive. That's going to be bad. Don't steal from soup kitchens. Steal from people who can afford to lose it and probably should. Otherwise, bad things will happen. Again, this is part of the tone. And so go ahead and taunt that person a little bit before you start really thinking about it. That way we can all know why you hate that person. And now the first thing that you're going to have to do is you're going to have to get your team together. This goes along with some stuff we talked about in the action movie in terms of assembling people to help you survive. You need to find specialists. Maybe a demolitions guy, a safe cracker, someone who's good at sleight of hand so they can like steal things or move things around without anyone noticing. A computer hacker would be good. A good con man who can impersonate people and pretend to be someone he's not, that'd be great. An inside man is fantastic. If you can find someone who's inside the company or inside the bank, and the con man can help you out there. And also, very, very important, you need an attractive female for diversionary purposes, because there'll be times where you just need, you know, the attractive blonde in the short dress to distract the guards so you can slip past the metal detectors or whatever. That's probably the most important. The rest of them are good, and here's an important thing. Make sure each one of them has some weird quirk that's kind of comical. Because again, you get too serious, you're going to get killed in a shootout with the police. I don't know why that is, but it seems to be the case. And stay away from like edgy ex-military, ex-cop kind of guys. Those guys are going to be bad news as well. Like I said, what you want to do is you want to find the computer hacker who always has to be eating a bowl of Cheetos or something like that, some sort of weird quirk. That's a guy who's good for you. Those other people who are a little too serious and who want to put on like dark face makeup and carry on automatic weapons, those are for the action movies. They're not for your heists. Those are going to bring the unwanted attention of the police to you. So once you have your team together, you need to plan the heist. The most important thing you can do, and I can't stress this enough, a lot of people like to cheap out, you want to get good charts and maps. So spend some money, maybe, you know, contract out to a graphic designer, go down to the local Kinko's or whatever printing shop you want to use. You need full color, nice maps. Transparencies are a real bonus because, you know, you don't want to have a rushed planning job. You want elaborate models and miniatures if you can, and all this costs a bit of coin, but you know what they say, it takes money to make money. You want your planning to look maybe as though your briefing room had been carefully designed by some of the best Hollywood set designers and art designers, that kind of thing. You don't want some sort of slipshod, hand-drawn maps, because that's not going to be professional. And, you know, again, the key is to be a professional, to keep it light, kind of fun, and, you know, have fun with it. So make sure that these maps and these charts and these little miniature model things are cool and clever. And you probably also want to build sets, because look, that bank vault with the motion sensors that if you go faster than however slow the motion sensors go, the steel gates drop and out come the guys with the shotguns, you want to avoid having to do those in an actual production environment. So what you want is to have sets. Again, think of the movies, almost like rehearsing a movie. You want to have an exact replica. Now, you know, you would think that this would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to exactly replicate the super secret bank vault that you've already stolen the plans for, but you can do it cheap. Just look around, maybe check out Craigslist or something to find some people to help you out with it. I'll bet you can put that together. You know, go to local colleges, find some people who are in the theater, drama department, maybe they can help you out in building these awesome sets for your rehearsals, because you're going to need to do some dry runs, and you can't really go to the actual CIA headquarters at Langley to use their super secret computer room when you're going to rip off the magical disc from their computer system. You also want to be casing your enemy. Send one of your guys, you know, maybe he's got a personality quirk like he rubs his ear a lot or something, and he's kind of shifty. You want to have him casing out your enemy. You know, just follow the enemy around, get to know the place. Again, you want to steal plans if you can. That's going to be really helpful. Again, you don't want to sort of have to go in there and just start shooting. That's going to wind up with you getting killed tragically at the end. So avoid that if at all you can. And the last thing you want to do is try and acquire some snazzy uniforms. Maybe black suits or gray suits. You know, get color coordinated. If people are going to be trying to pretend to be other people, make sure that you go to good tailors. You want to definitely try and, if you can, have a tailor, because I think you're going to be better off if you can have, you know, right before the big day, yourself being measured in your underwear by a tailor. I don't know, that seems to help. Part of the tone thing. Keep it light, keep it fun, keep it professional. Look, you're not an animal. You want to look good, and if you want to steal, you have to look good. Otherwise, again, guys with guns, that kind of thing. As for the heist itself, the big key is going to be misdirection. Like I said, you want to avoid shooting people, and you want to get in and out without having anyone get killed. So pretend to be doing something that you're not. You know, set off a fire alarm somewhere so that you can steal something somewhere else, that kind of thing. Keep your enemy and the other guys guessing where you are.
But Stephen, we should also mention the part of performing the heist that's absolutely important to get right is the part where you avoid the laser eyes, the hidden laser eyes. You need an aerosol spray can, and you just need to spray it in front of you as you walk down every corridor. And eventually you'll come to a part where there's laser beams that are going to be set off if you keep walking down there. But the nice thing about these is that there's always a space somewhere for you to slip by. So you can go underneath or the side or whatever. There's always enough room to get by even though they have these. You just have to avoid it. And if they're moving, you need to be dancing. As long as you dance on your way through, then you'll be fine. You know, you don't have to worry about timing your movements or anything. Just dance and then walk through and the laser eyes will not see you.
And when something goes wrong, and it will, what you want to do is improvise. Don't start speaking French because that's going to be bad. You know, you don't want to start cursing in French. Whatever you do, just improvise, keep rolling with it, or, better yet, when something goes wrong, reveal that it was actually all a part of the plan that you hadn't told everybody. Be one step ahead of chance and fate itself, and that way you're sure to get away. And getting away after you've stolen whatever it is that you've stolen, and of course, I'm not going to go into the details of how to actually do the heist. You know, you're going to have the computer hacker hack the alarm systems while the safe cracker opens the safe because the demolitions guy gets off a big bomb that caused a distraction for some other people, and the hot chick distracted the guards so you can sneak into the vault at the exact same time the safe cracker was ready to go, and the computer hacker had the system disabled, and you can get in and out. Anyway, now you have to get out. And that's going to be tough to do. What you've got to do, again, is misdirection. Remember what I said about that? So, let's say you're pretending to escape. What do? Really, you lock yourself into the vault. Or, if they think that you're in the vault with this money, really, you've escaped. That's what you want to do. Go ahead and announce what you're doing to the bad guy, and do the opposite. Remember, bad guys aren't that smart. If you tell them, hey, I'm in your computer room and I have the disk, they're going to surround the computer room and eventually you're going to breach it with the SWAT guys and, uh-oh, you're already at Monte Carlo. Too bad, buddy boy. That's what you want to be doing. So do the opposite of what you claim to be doing. Now, once it's all said and done, you want to try and avoid any really comical means of travel. Stay off of trains. I don't know, for whatever reason, trains are trouble. Bad guys like to show up and apprehend you on trains. What you want to do, stick to cars, take the late-night plane out of there, you know, don't get anything too crazy, don't avoid motorcycles, those are going to encourage people to start chasing you down and shooting you, and, you know, unless you're in an action movie, I would just say to avoid motorcycles, period. And you probably want to retire to a nice tropical resort someplace. I would probably recommend keeping your cell phone around with you, because you're probably going to need at some point in time, if you're very successful the first time, to do yet another final big score in the future, and these tips will work well for you then as well. The movie sequel is something that we've all sort of grown up with, and it's just part of movies today. But unfortunately, most sequels are pretty much the same as the original, with maybe a different title. This is not always the case, however, and today in our top six list, we want to talk about movies that are distinctly different from the original. So these are sequels that are not like either the movie that came before them or earlier movies in the film series, and you'll get a better feeling of it when we start talking about our actual movies. Now, normally I try and pick good movies for my list, but I couldn't resist taking a couple of bad ones this time just because they're such an interesting diversion from the originals. So, my number six on the list this week is a film we've talked about before, and that's Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, directed in 1982 by the great director Tommy Lee Wallace, and by great, I mean not at all great. The first two Halloween movies are these sort of fairly subtle psychological thrillers that are, you know, kind of slasher flicks, but they're not like, you know, the Jason movies. They're actually pretty scary and tense. Halloween 3, however, completely disregards everything about the first two Halloween movies, which are about the serial killer stalking his sister. Halloween 3 is about evil Halloween masks that shoot snake lasers at people. Anyway, we talked about that back in episode 5, so go check it out. But yeah, nothing like its first couple movies.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that, though, is the first two movies are tied together more closely than most sequels are. Halloween 2 takes place literally the very instant that Halloween 1 ends, and then it continues the same story on the same night, and then suddenly we're completely unrelated. It's just odd. Well, I also cheated a little bit and included in my number 6 slot a movie I don't actually like, but it's just too crazy not to mention. It's the last entry in the Shaft trilogy from the 1970s.
Ooh.
Richard Roundtree plays the anti-hero Shaft in the 1971 film of the same name, and it's one of the earliest in what was called the blaxploitation genre. It's kind of like the hard-boiled detective films of the 1940s, and exaggerating the corruption and the violence and the moral decay and moving them into the 70s. Well, anyway, the first two films, called Shaft and Shaft's Big Score the following year, are these gritty crime films, inner-city setting, and about drug dealers and corrupt cops and this private detective character that isn't on anybody's side. He's just on his own side. And then the third movie just up and moves Shaft into Africa, where he poses as this itinerant laborer to break open a slavery ring. I suppose the actual story keeps most of the same kinds of elements, but the shift in setting from urban America to the middle of the desert and these small African villages is just such a jolting change. I love the marketing tagline for this movie, though. It was, "The Brother Man in the Motherland."
Yeah, definitely an interesting change. I think, though, it does sort of foresee the trend a little bit of taking, we're going to take the character and just move him to a different setting and we'll be fine, which, though that's very, very strange. I mean, just such a weird juxtaposition. Well, my number 5 pick, another strange juxtaposition, and the title is one of those great all-time sequel titles. The title is Rambo First Blood Part 2. This is, of course, the second movie in the Rambo trilogy, which is soon to be a four-part series, or as Fox would call it, a quadrilogy. The first Rambo movie, called First Blood, starred Sylvester Stallone as this character who was this psychologically wounded Vietnam veteran who comes back and snaps, and some action, but a psychological thriller about the hardships of Vietnam and what it's like to come back to society and how war changes people. And, you know, it's actually got something to say. And then in Rambo First Blood Part 2, directed in 1985, a couple years later by George P. Cosmatos, it's going to be an action movie in which Rambo goes back into Vietnam to apparently just refight Vietnam. There are a lot of these movies in the 80s where heroes went back into Vietnam to, like, you know, finish what I guess we didn't do a very good job of the first time or something like that. There's those Chuck Norris movies and stuff too, but nothing in First Blood would ever prepare you to think that the producers of the series would decide to make just these outrageous action movies.
Yeah, it's nuts. First Blood, I like a lot. It's an action movie with a real brain to it. It's very intelligent. And if you haven't seen any Rambo movies and all you know is the iconic, cheesy imagery of Rambo, maybe give First Blood a look, because it actually is quite a good movie. He doesn't actually kill a single person in First Blood, even though that they are trying to kill him. He comes up with ways to disable them or just stop the pursuit and protect himself, but it is very much a movie oriented about the psychology of this one character who's just been driven nuts by the war, but still retains a sense of right and wrong. And then to just take that and just throw him in the middle of somewhere and just have him shoot everybody up indiscriminately is just a weird shift. Yeah. My number 5 is Army of Darkness, a movie I suspect would show up on your list, but it's a horror comedy from director Sam Raimi, and that was the sequel to The Evil Dead and The Evil Dead 2. The first movie was this shock horror movie that played things mostly pretty straight, and I didn't really like it at all. It's a cult favorite with a lot of people. I pretty much hated it.
Yeah, it's a terrible movie.
But the second is practically a remake of it, but as a black comedy, and I kind of like that one. And then Army of Darkness just comes out of nowhere and transports the main character back into medieval times, and it's this over-the-top, campy slapstick dark comedy. I mean, if you took Evil Dead 2 out of the series and you were left with The Evil Dead and Army of Darkness, there would not be recognizable as belonging to the same series at all. Evil Dead 2 bridges the gap a little bit, but still, Army of Darkness just comes out of just nowhere.
Yeah, I thought about this. It's actually not on my list, but it's definitely a good pick and one that fits in well. Well, my number 4 movie is a pretty decent movie, but it is kind of a cheat because it's not exactly a true sequel, and that's the 1998 Tony Scott film Enemy of the State,
which is a sort of sequel to the great 1970s film The Conversation by Francis Ford Coppola. It's not a sequel in name, but Gene Hackman is in both of those films and playing essentially the same character. And in Enemy of the State, it's 20 years later, and the character has a different name, but I think unofficially he's the same character. He didn't have the rights to it, but unofficially he's the same character that he was in The Conversation. What makes it interesting is The Conversation is a really, really strange 70s, very psychological movie. The Gene Hackman character is this sound engineer who may have recorded something that people are trying to get him for. And Enemy of the State is a pretty decent, just straight-ahead action flick in which Gene Hackman's character is once again this sound engineer who has a very similar backstory. He's been on the run from the government for all this time, but you know, nothing in The Conversation would ever suggest that there would be able to transport this character and put him in an action movie, but that's exactly what happens, and it's kind of a lot of fun. I like both movies, and I think it's interesting if you've seen the first one and you just go ahead and pretend that they're really the same character.
Really interesting choice there. Well, number four on my list is a latter-day John Wayne Western called Rooster Cogburn, made in 1975. Ooh. Rooster Cogburn is the name of the character he plays, and it's a sequel to True Grit, probably a better-known movie than its sequel. True Grit has just what it says it has, true grit. It's down and dirty, it's action-oriented, it's a Western, obviously, with a no-nonsense anti-hero he's a stubborn drunk that likes to do things his way or no way, kind of a precursor to a lot of 70s action heroes like Dirty Harry and Charles Bronson in Death Wish and that kind of thing. Anyway, then comes the movie Rooster Cogburn in 1975, right in the thick of this movement that True Grit sort of, you know, started in a way, but the sequel has some of the action and some of the attitude, but not nearly so much. It plays much, much better if you don't go in with particular expectations of seeing another real action-oriented Western. Because in this one, Cogburn meets up with a woman played by Katharine Hepburn, and she has this tempering effect on this character, and the movie is essentially a character piece in an action setting rather than the other way around. It's actually reminiscent a little bit of the character dynamic in The African Queen, which Hepburn also starred in. Anyway, both True Grit and Rooster Cogburn are excellent movies, but the latter is certainly not the typical do-it-again-but-bigger type of sequel.
Yeah, you know, I like both those movies. I didn't think about that. That is a pretty good pick. But yeah, they are pretty different. It's kind of weird. I think a lot of times kind of True Grit's pretty well respected. Rooster Cogburn, not as well. But I don't know. I like them both, and I think it's interesting for sure. Well, my number three movie, Aliens from 1986 by James Cameron. Of course, Alien, directed by Ridley Scott, and stars Sigourney Weaver as a woman on this transport ship that they pick up this weird alien creature, and it basically feels like a horror movie. There's no guns involved, and it's just this thing stalking them through the corridors. And then, so for the sequel, James Cameron took over and worked on the script and directed it, and James Cameron is an action director, you know, famous for especially the Terminator series, and it's just all out, straight out action. Definitely, it has some tense moments that kind of harken back to the original, but the original subtle horror movie where you barely see the creature is completely replaced by a squad of space marines that are going to go blow the living crap out of these things, and it's just a great, great action movie. I love it, but yeah, it's very, very different. And the Alien series is interesting in how different each entry is. In fact, Alien 3 kind of goes back to a bunch of people without any weapons, and I have no idea what's going on in Alien 4, but it is interesting how different it is. And of course, also Aliens, one of the great sequel titles, Alien and then Aliens. I've always thought that was very clever. Unfortunately for Alien 3, all they could come up with was Alien 3, so I think you can definitely see the decline of the series at that point.
Yeah, Aliens is a great pick. I considered it, wound up not including it, but I had a feeling you would. Well, my number three, starting in 1991, martial arts star Jet Li made a series of films about the Chinese folk hero Wong Fei-hung, and it's a fantastic action series, definitely with a martial arts slant to it, but a lot more accessible and with higher production values than what we think of as a martial arts chop-socky flick. These are pretty upscale action movies, clearly influenced by American action movies, while, you know, still retaining a Chinese sensibility about them, which is appropriate because, in fact, these movies are all about the westernization of China when Britain opened up China for Western settlement. So that's the backdrop for the plots of intrigue that drive these movies. Well, there are six in total. The first three are all clearly episodes of the same series, have the same look and feel. It's questionable if 4 and 5 even qualify to be part of the series because they don't star Jet Li and aren't about Wong Fei-hung and aren't very good, so we'll just pretend they don't exist. But for the sixth movie, sometimes titled Once Upon a Time in China 6 and other times Once Upon a Time in China and America, It's very definitely a continuation of the series with Jet Li back in the role, but it's just completely different. For one thing, it's in America. The title is a complete misnomer, and it's about Wong Fei-hung discovering and fighting the oppression of the Chinese in the American West. It's as good a movie as the others in the series, but it's weird because suddenly we've got basically a Western. It's got a martial arts slant to it again, so it's strange, but when you think about it, it's also a logical continuation of the series, which is all about this clash of cultures. By the way, if you're thinking about Shanghai Noon, you've probably got the wrong idea. These aren't comedies. They're fun, but they're more serious action movies.
Well, my number two pick is not at all serious action movies. They're pretty different, but it's a trilogy of films directed roughly at the same time and released between 1993 and 1994 by the Polish filmmaker Krzysztof Kieślowski, and it's the Three Colors trilogy. The first film is blue, the second film is white, and the third is red. These were largely made in France. They take place, I think, in France and Switzerland. Very, very interesting because each one is distinctly different from the others, and yet all share characters and all sort of take place in the same universe. Blue is a tragedy about a woman coping with her life after the loss of her family. White is a very, very dark comedy about a man whose wife leaves him. And red is a kind of tender love story. And it's interesting because all three of them feel really different. They each have a distinctly different look. This is very intentional. The cinematography in each one takes on sort of the hue of the title. So blue has a very blue look to it. It's sort of sad. And white has a more bleak and white look. And red, of course, the love story, a more warm, kind of happy story. And none of them at all feel like they quite are in the same series, but definitely each one feels part of a grand whole. And I remember when I finished up Red, I was just blown away by what I had just witnessed and how everything kind of ties together at the end. There's this strange bit that ties them all together at the very end of Red that it doesn't really seem like that big of a deal, but for some reason, when you just feel the shared universe all coming together, it's just really amazing. And they're just wonderful films. Blue starts off a little slow. You should probably watch them all in order. Blue starts off a little slow, but by the time White gets going, you're really, really into this world and these characters.
Yeah, I love these movies too, particularly Red and White. It's very funny. Blue, I think, is the most beautiful of the three. They all have their attributes. Well, we spoke a lot about my number two choice just recently on the show, so I won't go into as much detail, but it's Stolen Kisses from 1968, the third film in François Truffaut's series about his semi-autobiographical character, Antoine Doinel. Without repeating ourselves too much, Stolen Kisses is light and funny and quirky and whimsical and colorful and romantic, and it's the sequel to the 400 Blows in the short film Antoine and Colette, which are more serious dramas, although the overall themes about finding love and freedom in life do line up pretty nicely.
Yeah, I consider that film as well, but we just talked about it, so I said it not to. Glad you mentioned it, though, because it does deserve to be on this list. My number one, I think, is about as different a sequel as you can get to, and whether or not it's a true sequel or not, it's a little bit debatable, but let me give you a little bit of background. In 1953, Fred Zinnemann directed an adaptation of the James Jones novel From Here to Eternity, and it's a really great drama about a series of characters that are all living in Hawaii in 1941, just before the attack on Pearl Harbor, and it's sort of about the aftermath of that and how it affects their lives. Well, it turns out Jones wrote a series of novels about these characters and stuff, and there's a sequel called The Thin Red Line. And in 1998, director Terrence Malick adapted that novel. It had been adapted previously, but no one really cares about that adaptation too much. And the Terrence Malick version of The Thin Red Line from 1998 is so completely different from Here to Eternity, it's not even describable. The Thin Red Line is about a battle in Guadalcanal, but the movie doesn't seem all that interested in war scenes, though. It's about 3 hours long. About a third of it, I think, is devoted to this extended battle where the U.S. Marines are trying to take this bunker. But, man, the movie is like this weird meditation on war and nature and human existence. Sam's not a big fan of it, I don't think, because it gets really pretentious at times. It's all these scenes of characters sort of reciting poetry and talking to themselves, and there's just a million characters, and they're all indistinguishable, and it's nothing at all like the focused character drama of the 1953 film From Here to Eternity. There's no way you could ever, ever anticipate that this film would be coming after that one. And again, there are a lot of the same characters show up in both. I mean, I guess you could call it an adaptation of a book series. I don't know if it's a direct sequel, but I guess it kind of is. I mean, The Godfather 2 is a sequel to The Godfather 1, the film, and The Thin Red Line is kind of a sequel to From Here to Eternity.
Well, The Godfather shared actors and a director, and it was pretty clearly made to capitalize on The Godfather. This one, I think it was pretty clearly made not to be a sequel at all. It was made to be a whole film. Not that I'm disagreeing with you. That was a brilliant choice. I wish I had even thought of it. It didn't even occur to me because, you know, who thinks of that as a series? Well, my number one distinctly different sequel is from 1998, and it is a bit more connected than The Thin Red Line is. It is entitled Babe, Pig in the City. I just have no idea where this one came from. The 1995 original was this sunny, chipper movie about a pig that could herd sheep. And it's a great family film that's entertaining for children and adults alike, so I definitely recommend that. Its sequel, Babe, Pig in the City, takes this sharp turn off into this dark, expressionistic nightmare world. We talked about expressionism recently. This is another expressionistic cityscape that you might have seen in Metropolis. But the pig gets lost in the city, and the villains are chasing him, and it's just so bizarre. It really threw me a loop when I first saw it. I wasn't sure what to make of it, and I still prefer the original, but it's pretty hard to compare them anyway. This dystopian city is absolutely nothing like where you'd think the first movie would take you. The city is just wonderful. It is pretty original, even though it was inspired, as I say, by Metropolis and some other things, but it has its own feel to it, and it's cobbled together from a bunch of different cities with their own recognizable landmarks. We got the Statue of Liberty in one place, and the Hollywood sign in another, and, you know, all these different things are cobbled together in this one dark, crowded super city. Gene Siskel actually named this as his number one movie of 1998, and Ebert also placed it in his top 10. I can't go that far, but I do really love the visual aspects of the movie and have nothing but respect for the idea of doing a sequel that does something completely and utterly new instead of just trying to recapture the spirit of the original with a retread.
Just as long as that sequel is not Rambo First Blood Part 2.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, definitely. Babe in the Pig in the City is an interesting choice. Dystopian cityscapes were kind of in 1998. Roger Ebert's film of that year was another dystopian cityscape, Dark City.
Yeah.
I think those two movies would make a fascinating double feature. Maybe we'll have to talk about that sometime in the future.
Okay.
So to recap, my top six list of sequels that are distinctly different from their originals, and that's a mouthful. My number six is Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, directed in 1982 by someone who probably prefers to remain nameless, and if he doesn't, he should. My number five is another bad movie, Rambo First Blood Part 2, directed by George P. Cosmatos in 1985. Moving into good movie territory, my number four is Enemy of the State, maybe kind of a sequel by Tony Scott, directed in 1998, the sort of sequel to The Conversation. My number three is Aliens, James Cameron's 1986 action sequel to Alien. My number two is the whole trilogy, The Three Colors. Well, I guess only white and red would really qualify as sequels because the first one's not. But anyway, close enough. Directed between 1993 and 1994 by Krzysztof Kieslowski. And my number one film that's distinctly different from its original is The Thin Red Line, directed in 1998 by Terrence Malick, and a sort of sequel to the 1953 film From Here to Eternity.
My number six is Shaft in Africa, The Brother Man in the Motherland from 1973. Number five, Army of Darkness from 1992. Number four, Rooster Cogburn from 1975, the sequel to True Grit. Number three, Once Upon a Time in China and America from 1997. Number two, Stolen Kisses from 1968. And number one, Babe, Pig in the City from 1998. We're going to do a short segment now about a couple of books that you may be interested. They're both about making movies, but I think they're interesting even if you're not interested in actually making movies, but you might be interested in how movies are put together or a lot of the artistic process or even the technical process. So if you're interested in that, we have a couple of books we'd like to talk about. One of them, and interestingly, they're both about accomplished directors.
Whose names end in E.T.
Whose names end in E.T. and look like they're French so you don't pronounce the T, but you actually do. But they're great reads. The first one, and by far the most engaging book I've ever read on the subject, a real easy read actually, is called Making Movies by Sidney Lumet, the director of such movies as 12 Angry Men, The Dog Day Afternoon, Murder on the Orient Express, and Network, and a bunch of other good movies. This book, surprisingly slim for all the information it contains, walks you through the filmmaking process from beginning to end, a chapter on each kind of phase of the process, and talks a bit about not just how it's done, but the things you have to think about and consider along the way. There's a chapter on, well, just to pick an example, lighting. It sounds boring, but it's interesting to hear Lumet talk about the things that have to be considered when you make decisions on how to light a scene, because lights can be harsh or soft, white or tinted, coming from above or below, or just be ambient. All these little decisions have a subtle effect on the impact of the scene. And so you hear Lumet talk about his thought process. Well, this movie needs to convey this kind of feeling to it, or this movie's about this kind of character, so we need to light it this way. And of course, he makes the same sorts of decisions about a lot of other things besides lighting. Lighting's just one chapter.
One of the things that makes it a particularly good book is that Lumet is a very gifted technical director. His movies are some of the best looking and best put together out there. He obviously pays a lot of attention to those details. I think maybe some other directors don't put as much thought into those, but Lumet certainly really seems to understand the technical side of how movies are made.
Yeah, and to pick an example of cinematography in 12 Angry Men, as the movie progresses, the camera kind of gets lower down, and he changes focal lengths on his lenses so that the room's walls will appear to be smaller and smaller as it goes on, to increase this feeling of claustrophobia. Also in this book, there's a lot of interesting things on the dynamics of working with other people, how to work with actors and producers and so on. He has all kinds of little insightful observations. Like, for example, in the first round table meeting with everybody, you know, everybody's going to make a movie, and they have a round table meeting and make sure they're on the same page and everything. He observes that the writer is always the guy who's most nervous at the table. He's the most nervous person there because nobody else has done anything yet. So if anything is wrong, it's the writer's fault. And later on, everybody else can pass the buck.
Right. And Lumet's a great storyteller, which really helps. The book is sort of alternates between technical discussions and really good stories and interesting anecdotes from his movies. And he's had such a varied career, it makes it easy to read.
Yeah, so it's a great read, quick, easy, surprisingly packed with information, and sort of as a side effect, some great insights into Lumet's own work, because he uses his own examples from his own movies to illustrate the points he's making.
One thing I want to point out is I have an entire shelf of movie textbooks, and I would probably, if I could only keep one book about movies, I would keep Lumet's. It's the smallest and also the most informative and useful and just dense with information, just great.
I'll talk about a second one here that's also about making movies. It's not quite as an easy read, but certainly interesting. It's called On Directing Film by writer-director David Mamet. And this book is much more focused than Lumet's. It's also a lot more intellectual, but it provides some great insight about how to tell stories visually. I think that's what the focus of this is. I think most of us are familiar with words to express ideas. We do that pretty much every day. But telling stories in a visual medium is a whole different kind of thing, and this book really does a good job of explaining why and the different mode of thinking you have to be in. The chapters of the book are varying, not just in content, but format as well. One chapter might be an essay about some particular topic, then the next chapter is a transcript of him teaching a class and the dialogue he has with his students. And this, I think, is my favorite chapter in the book, because you really see a creative process unfold as this dialogue happens with his students. His assignment is, well, why don't you think of a scene to shoot? And so they come up with something, and they talk about how they're going to construct the scene to tell the story. And he says, all right, well, that's a good idea, but how about this? Or, you know, well, that's not a good idea because whatever. He comes up with different reasons and maybe some improvements on how to tell a story visually and make it compact. So you're not just filming a movie of somebody narrating events. And it's just fascinating to see this quick little snippet of a movie take shape in our heads as the discussion progresses. It starts out pretty open-ended, and gradually this theoretical scene evolves from something that maybe gets the job done but is sort of clumsy into a few seconds of film that we can just imagine are so sharp and elegant, and you come away pretty impressed with how much story you can really fit into just a few quick shots.
Sounds great. I haven't read it, Sam, but I really hope to. David Mamet is interesting that he wrote a book on directing, because I think of him mainly as a writer. I like his movies, but I love his scripts, I think, more than I like his directing.
And actually, when he wrote this, he had only directed two movies. He had come off of House of Games and Things Change. And he even said in the preface, you know, there's nothing more dangerous than somebody who has done a little bit of dabbling in something, and then he goes off and writes a book on it. So he's kind of self-aware that he's maybe not the most experienced director to be talking about this at this time, but definitely he has some fascinating insights. It's the end of the episode, and so, of course, we have to give the answer to our trivia question, and that is, what was Charlie Chaplin really eating when he ate a boot in the movie The Gold Rush? Now, Stephen, you said you didn't know what it was. I'm kind of scared to ask if you have a guess.
Was it actually a boot?
No, it wasn't an actual boot.
I thought you were going for a trick question.
No, it wasn't a trick question either. No, the boot was made of licorice, actually. Put a licorice boot on your plate and eat it, and presto, you got cinema history. There were complications, though, that to get the scene right, Chaplin did 63 takes of the scene, and afterwards he suffered insulin shock and had to go to the hospital.
Well, you know, a true artist that suffers for his art.
The motel was as seedy as a plump slice of watermelon. I scraped my feet on the mat and slipped into my room. Episode 20 was done for, as finished as my first marriage. No sooner as I sloughed off my jacket and loosened my tie when a half-hearted knock came from the door. The bellhop scowl was effortless, the kind deeply ingrained from too many years of public service. "Telegram for you, Mr. Noir," he said, and his voice was as blunt as the tip of his shiny red nose. "Let's hear it, pal," I said, flicking the fedora off my ears. "Coming to visit. Stop. 7 days. Stop. Neo." I tossed him a nickel. He snatched it up like a vulture and left. I sat at the desk, lit a cigar, and blew smoke rings around the room's resident mosquito. I flipped open my laptop and surfed over to allmovietalk.com, the best website for movie podcasts. It wasn't much, but it was home. Page. 7 days. In 7 days, my brother Neo would swoop over this town like my ex-wife over the alimony check. I hadn't seen him in -17 years. Little brother Neo. Neo Noir. Cut! That was brilliant, although the camera was facing the wrong way, but everything else was fine.